This is my favorite part of the show.
Season two, you're doing open ballot. Welcome to season one, episode 13 of the Swift Over Coffee podcast. I'm Paul Hudson.
And I'm Sean Allen.
And how is your job hunt going, Sean?
I mean, hunt is a strong word. I don't know if I'd call it a hunt just yet. It's pretty passive. Like, I haven't gone on the offensive, like really reaching out to people. Really, all I've done is, as I mentioned it on the last episode of this podcast, in the video I put out looking for my replacement, you know, I kind of mentioned I'd be moving on. So just based on that, I've had, you know, quite a few companies like or people that work at those companies reach out to me and got a couple interesting opportunities that I'm pursuing right now. So
nice.
Hopefully, if all goes well, the offensive won't be needed. So that'll be nice. What are you been up to, Paul?
I just got back from Cluj-Napoca, which is sort of the west area of Romania, actually in Transylvania. I was there speaking about string interpolation in Swift 5. I saw really two fantastic things. First, they had probably the best male-female attendee split I've ever seen at a coding conference, which I think is awesome. And second, they had to make everyone in the iOS and Android rooms swap places because iOS outnumbered Android by so much. It was just fantastic.
That's funny. But let's back up a little bit. I'm curious. What is the best male-female attendee split? Because that's a pretty low bar, right?
Yeah. So I think this year, so W18 now, was the first year I've seen any dub have queues for female toilets, mm-hmm. which is like a, you know, it's an unusual metric to use,
right.
but an important one. You can see it's at least enough for that to happen. So that's a good thing. Yeah, it doesn't take much, mostly. You know, often you'll see events where, and I went to one last year in Amsterdam where it was maybe 1 in 30, 1 in 20. It was very low, like impossibly low. And they also only had two female speakers.
Okay.
So out of a large number, it was a four-track conference. They had two female speakers, which is awful. Whereas here, I'd say it's probably 25, 35% or so.
Oh, that's pretty good.
It was excellent. Yeah, very, very good.
All right, Paul, let's talk about some news this week. And first up, we have an article from Joe Groff of the Swift core team. He released an article all about evolving Swift on Apple platforms after ABI stability. This builds on a really good article from Jordan Rose a few days earlier, where he laid out exactly what ABI stability was, what it means, and it has nice diagrams, pictures, and everything.
I think, isn't it awesome seeing them post blog posts regularly? I love it.
That is very true. It was very, very quiet for a very long time. And now it seems like they're, you know, they're experimenting with putting themselves out there, which I like, which I think I remember maybe it was last Dub, Ted Kremenek said that he wanted the Swift core team to be much more involved in the community. So good to see that we're seeing that come to fruition. So if you're not familiar with ABI stability, you're probably wondering what the hell we're talking about. And first of all, ABI stands for Application Binary Interface. And essentially, ABI stability means that the Swift runtime library will be included in the operating systems like iOS, macOS, tvOS, watchOS, which means we will no longer need to include it in our apps, which reduces the download size. Sounds like a pretty good win, but as always, there's a trade-off, right, Paul?
Well, there's always a trade-off in these things, particularly when you think that if Swift gets bundled into the OS, it could restrict which features we can use in the future. You know, if we want to use new things in Swift 6, for example, like async await or who knows what, we need to make sure we're also targeting versions of the OS that ship with it. But ultimately, I think that the main thing is that it's actually happening. ABI stability is finally happening. Xcode 10.2 beta ships in Swift 5. We're really close now, and I'm just looking forward to seeing how quickly adoption picks up once things are set in stone for real.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to watch. And moving on, the next article by Andrew Mattson, where he does his best to answer the question, how many apps are using Swift in 2019? And in the article, he mentions that, you know, 3 years ago in early 2016, he read a post by Ryan Olson where Ryan found that in the top 100 apps, only 11% of them were using Swift, you know, in some manner, right? Because a lot of the apps then were like, you know, some Objective-C, some Swift. So Andrew wanted to get a 2019 update. So that's exactly what he did. He went and downloaded the top 110 free apps from the store, decrypted them, wrote a little script to determine whether or not they're using Swift, and roughly what percentage of the app was in Swift. And, you know, he describes his methodology in the article if you want to dive into that. But he says it's really impossible to get the exact numbers, but, you know, you can see how he got there. Anyway, Paul, do you think we're higher or lower than that 11% number from 2016?
Well, I'd like to think if you and I have been doing our jobs, it should be higher, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it's a very good point. The number is higher, and that is 100% completely thanks to us, right?
100%.
Just us. Seriously, though, he discovered that 42% of all apps, you know, games included, were using Swift in some manner. So that's quite a big jump from 11%. But when you take out the games from the equation, you know, that number jumps up to 57% that are using Swift. So again, quite a jump from that 11%.
Well, it certainly makes sense that games are behind apps in terms of adoption. You know, lots of those are built using cross-platform frameworks like Unity or Unreal Engine or similar. I expect the number will continue to creep upwards slowly, but probably not going to see another massive jump until the next sort of apocalypse when Apple eventually kills apps that haven't been updated for the Notch, for example. That'll trim out older Objective-C apps that just aren't maintained anymore.
That's a good point. I didn't think of that. That Objective-C number has to be artificially propped up, right, by old apps that are, you know, no longer maintained. So yeah, when those get finally, you know, culled away, it should be interesting to see what that number jumps up to.
I think my very first Swift app is still on the App Store, you know. Swift 1.0.
When was the last time you updated that?
Never. Literally, Swift 1.0. Swift 1.0, shipped it on day one of the GM. And never touched it since.
Nice. So next up, we have a repo from Jesse Squires called Esoteric Swift. And he says it best. I'll just read the repo description to sum this up. It says, this project aims to collect bizarre, but legal, Swift programs that the community produces, like esoteric programming languages, but for weird or nonsensical blank we do in Swift that actually compiles for fun purposes only. This is a family-friendly show, Paul. The less comprehensible, the better. Just like normal code, which, you know, I love that last line.
This reminds me of one of the all-time great coding competitions, which is the IOCCC, the International Obfuscated C Code Competition. It's been running on and off since the early 80s or so, mid-80s, and it encourages folks to submit C programs that are creatively obfuscated. And sometimes that means doing bizarre things with a preprocessor. Sometimes it means abusing language quirks to get unintended results. Or sometimes it means doing weird things in a roundabout way. And actually, cunningly, most of the code looks like it isn't actually valid C, and yet it still works.
Nice. So, okay, moving on. Real quick, news tidbit here to remind everybody out there. If you have a developer account, Apple is going to require you to enable two-factor authentication by February 27th. So, if you haven't set that up yet, better get on it.
This is one of those things I thought was a real non-issue, until I saw so many folks complaining about it. Unfortunately, it seems you can associate a second account with your device, so it really is a non-issue. But I do wonder, what's with the short timescale? Like, yeah, now, you've got two weeks to go.
I've had it set up for a while, so this was a non-issue for me, but I know many people out there don't. All right, to wrap up the news, the final thing is, we got a little bit of a leak on some WWDC dates. I guess there was a little mix up with some, I believe, the Marriott Hotel or the San Jose, you know, city released some dates by accident. Anyway, it looks like WWDC is going to be June 3rd through the 7th. Paul, you excited? Are you making the trip?
I am totally over the moon. I can't wait. It is such a great time of the year. I've already booked my hotel. As soon as it's finally confirmed, i.e. by Apple, I'll book a flight straight away, apply for a ticket for the lottery, and so forth. It's going to be awesome. How about you?
Yeah, I'm going to put in for the lottery for my first time ever. I've never actually applied. So we're going to go ahead and do that. Hopefully they give me a little first timer advantage. That'd be pretty sweet. it was awesome hanging out with you last year at DubDub. That's where Paul and I met, and kind of this whole thing kind of started. So that was a lot of fun, and looking forward to doing that again. Although we'll have just seen each other like 2 months before in London for iOSCon, so it won't be that bad.
I think we're really lucky that Tim Cook listens to the show, because I'm sure he'll wangle you a ticket.
For sure, of course.
Go on, Tim.
Tim, you got it. As always, with every episode, let's talk about some picks. What do you got for us, Paul?
So my pick this episode is a new framework from Derek Solander called Lolzwagon, with a Z, Lolzwagon.
Nice.
You're already getting hyped, right? You're loving this thing already, right? It's written in Objective-C, and it makes a startling promise. It will dramatically increase your code coverage and make all your unit tests pass. Yes, really.
So are you telling me I just wasted like $40-something on your testing book? Like I don't have to read that anymore? Sweet.
Not quite. You see, it does actually accomplish these feats, but it does so in a wonderfully, marvelously, brilliantly sneaky way. It uses Objective-C method swizzling, to force all of XE test's functions to pass. So it doesn't matter how broken your code is, you still get a green light across the board.
And swizzling, this one, this concept kind of took me, I always thought it was a joke the first time I saw like method swizzling, just because of the name. I was like, what does that mean? So that's where you like just swap out one function for another, right?
Right, and Objective-C figures out all its function calls at runtime. It leans very heavily on dynamic dispatch. So it's fantastic at swizzling stuff. And I've swizzled so many methods in the past, even doing simple things back when it wasn't possible back in the iOS 4. So Lolzwagen goes through and rewrites all the XE test function calls. So they do literally nothing at all. And in XE test size, a test that makes no assertions is considered a pass still. It's, as long as there's no failures in there, it's still considered a pass.
So I guess I do have to read your book now. Is that what you're telling me? Is that what you're saying? You're saying this isn't going to take its place? And I can guess the code coverage boost is also not real? Like nothing about this is real?
It's just not real at all. But it's still pretty cool. If you run Lolzwagen in its default configuration, it will actually improve your code coverage a little bit with some hacks. So it's great out of the box. But if you enable the special gimme a raise Xcode configuration option, then it massively boosts code coverage, trying to get as near to 100% as it can.
All right, so you really got my hopes up, but it looks like really not much has changed now.
It's not like code coverage was much of a great metric to start with. This just makes it ever so slightly more useless. And let's face it, I'm sure you already have 100% test coverage right now because you have no tests. So
I was going to say 100% is zero. It's 100%.
They all pass. Yeah. They all pass right now. Yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah, yeah, it's amazing.
great code coverage. So my pick this week, Paul, is a nice article from Antoine Vanderlee all about speeding up your development productivity tips. Now, obviously, we don't want to go so fast that we're making mistakes, but I think we can all admit there's definitely some inefficiencies in our workflows, you know? And Antoine's got some nice tips that really resonated with me. So what do you say, Paul? Let's share some productivity tips.
Bring the heat. Bring it on. Whatever it is you say.
Was that a little bit of an American accent? Are you able to do an American accent? I think that'd be hilarious to hear.
Yeah, absolutely not. And it totally confused listeners too. Yeah. I think it's helped we sound so very different.
That is
at least
true.
In my head.
We should do it. No, we shouldn't do this, but it would be funny if we did an episode, you 100% in American accent, me 100% in a British accent. I think it'd be very, very cringeworthy.
Never live it down. No. When is April 1st anyway?
April 1st? So the first tip, that we're going to talk about, it sounds so simple, but I bet many of us don't do it. And that's turning on the do not disturb to just suppress all those notifications you get. Now, I remember to do this when I'm recording a video, for obvious reasons. I don't want all those notifications popping up on my tutorials. But when I'm like working or focusing, trying to get something built, I just never turn this on. It doesn't even occur to me. So I need to change that. Do you use do not disturb, Paul?
I use it in two situations. First, when I'm about to deliver a presentation live, and second, when I'm live streaming Swift on Sundays. For the former, though, macOS does do it automatically, so it's not really an issue. But I don't get that many notifications. Am I just like quite lonely, perhaps? I mean, I don't get that many happening to me.
I guess. I don't know. My Slack is going off. I guess anytime you're working at a company, like the Slack is what really goes nuts. That's what gets me. But yeah. Anyway. Next tip really hit home for me, speaking of Slack, and that is to not reply to your colleagues on Slack or whatever chat app you're using for 5 minutes. Antoine calls this the magic 5 minutes. And for me, this is tough. Like, I don't know. I just like to over deliver. So if somebody asks me a question on Slack, I'm always super quick to reply. But he brings up a good point, is that this can cause your coworkers to get used to that. And, they start asking you more and more questions over time, right? They get used to that. You're always going to get that answer right away. So another side effect of this is that often the coworker will, figure out the answer for themselves within that quote unquote magic 5 minutes. And I know I've done this. I've sent off a question on Slack. Then 2 minutes later, I have to send that never mind message because like I figured it out, so that's always embarrassing.
I think I like this one. I should probably try it out. I think particularly on Twitter, I feel obliged if I see it to reply to it very quickly. But recently I've kind of hit this point where Twitter only shows me some responses, which is very, very annoying. I have to press sort of show more button to see more and more responses. So I miss half of them anyway, and I'm sure I'm offending all sorts of people now that didn't reply to their tweet. But yeah, it's a natural magic 5 minutes thanks to Twitter.
Yeah, I'm pretty bad at that on Twitter too, and I you have like, I don't know, 2.5 something times the followers I do. So I can't even imagine what it's like for you. Twitter's getting pretty rough to handle for me. And I'm the same way. I try to reply to everybody and it's getting to be a little bit much and it is affecting my productivity. So the next tip, he borrows from John Sundell, and that is getting a lot of what he calls quick wins. These are small tasks you can complete in an hour or less. And I like these because it builds momentum. When I'm the most productive, it's when I'm just like, you know, knocking stuff out left and right on my list and, you know, starts to build excitement. Like, yeah, bring on the next thing. I got this. You know, it's like a snowball effect.
Yeah. So quick wins have been around for a long time. I think they come from Six Sigma originally. I use the same thing. I think John's tweet originally said something like he does 3-hour quick wins. I do sort of 10-minute quick wins.
Yeah, I was going to say, 3 hours does not sound quick.
Yeah, I do super fast quick wins because I like getting momentum. I like getting velocity. I like to see progress. You know, I did this massive snag list for my Unwrap app. And it was a big like, you know, 200-point list of changes I have to make. And, you know, I didn't delete them when I did it. I just checked them off. And it felt good. It just felt really good saying I've done these things. You know, even when I was, the next one's harder, at least I've done the previous ones. I've made some progress.
Yeah, it's all mental. You got to play these mental games with yourself sometimes. And the last tip, near and dear to our hearts, is that, you know, you should try to find time to passively learn via podcasts. He mentioned some of his favorites, like a little show called Swift Over Coffee, Swift by Sundell, Contravariants. But I agree. Podcasts are a great way to learn while doing other things. You know, for a commute is your perfect example. You know, if you're walking or driving, it's pretty tough to watch a video or read a book, but podcasts are great for this.
Yeah, so I find they work great at the gym because it's one of the few things you can do comfortably while completely distracted with something else. You know, I mean, not saying people ignore us, but you haven't got to be laser focused on what we're saying in order to get something from this. You enjoy it, you know, we're having a good time. There's some Swift in there. You can listen to the important bits later if you really want to. You haven't got to listen to every single word of what Sean says. But what I say, though, is pure gold.
You took my joke. I was going to say the same thing.
No!
You beat me to it. I guess we're just gonna end this here. We're going to the next section.
And let's head off to our open ballot. This time, our question was, if you could change one thing about Swift, what would it be? And we had so many responses. I mean, I could scroll and scroll through this massive document of answers we have here. We have so many. It's fantastic. Thank you so much, everyone. Lots of first-time responders as well, which is great to see. We'd love to hear more fresh views from folks. We're going to try and get through as many as we can, like usual. If we missed yours, I apologize. We did get so very, very many. I'm going to dive straight in with some language additions. We have one here from a Mr. Antoine V.D. Lee. Do you recognize this name?
I feel like we've said it quite a bit this episode. Yeah, it looks familiar.
Our pal Twannel, friend of the show, I would add an optional keyword option to protocol method definitions to make optional methods possible without @obc or without empty default protocol implementations. One from Kabir Oberai, I'd love to see built-in metaprogramming. If Swift natively included jib, sorcery style templating, we could do away with a lot of the cruft introduced with recent features like automatic codable, hashable, equatable conformance. And one from 0xproxy, default param values in protocols. So I understand where every one of these has come from. As Antoine says, the Swifty way of doing optional protocol method definitions is to have default protocol implementations, which is not very hard to do. So I'm not terribly worried about that one. Kabir does kind of answer his own question. He says if we had built-in jibs, which is generate your boilerplate, which is a Swift thing. So it does kind of have that, but I guess not natively. But I don't necessarily see the codable, hashable, equatable thing as being cruft. Actually, well, I like that stuff. But 0xproxy, I like that one. Default param values and protocols. I agree, it'd be nice to have that because right now you can't and it does annoy me a little bit. There's one thing I'd like to see, I mentioned on Twitter a few days ago, which is having a repeating count implementation for sequences that uses an auto closure rather than a fixed value. So you can say, please create me an array of 10 items. For each one, call this function or method. So it'll generate a different item for each thing in the array.
I'm actually on the same page as Antoine here. Yes, I get what you're saying. Adding that default protocol implementation isn't super hard. I don't know why it's necessary. Like I can imagine just having the optional keyword in front of the function, you know, should do the job.
I think it goes back to one of the fundamental differences of Objective-C and Swift, which is that in Objective-C, messaging nil does nothing at all. If you have a nil object, you say, hey, do this thing, nothing happens. That's a default implementation. So having optional methods you can call that do nothing is quite an Objective-C solution. Whereas in Swift, that isn't possible. You've got to say, I mean for this to do nothing. So it's that Swifty explicitness.
Gotcha.
We had some artists here taking ideas from other languages. One from Cyril Garcia saying, I recently learned that for loops in Python can have an else statement for when the loop finishes. And one from Matthew Hallett saying, user-defined type attributes would be cool, like discardable result and synchronized. It's a feature I've seen used in Kotlin and has some really cool applications for things like defining network resources and dependency injection.
So I'm not super familiar with these other languages, but let's clarify what Cyril's talking about. He's not talking about each iteration of the for loop having an else statement, right? He's talking about when the entire for loop is finished, then you have an else statement where you can do something.
Yeah, it's a really bizarre one, this. I don't think it's terribly Pythonic, at least not to my eyes. What it means is if the loop terminates successfully, if it goes through all items without break, then any code in the else block will run. So if you imagine saying, try and find this thing in the array by hand, loop over all the items, when you find it, break, then else won't run. But if you didn't find it, else will run.
Okay, gotcha. That makes a little sense.
It does. Makes a little sense.
Yes, a little sense. I don't see like that we need that.
No, if I was to have one thing, I'd love to see that. We talked about it previously, actually, in a previous episode, the optional loops. So it says something like, you know, if the array exists and has items in it, then go ahead and run this loop. Otherwise, do some other thing instead, like you get in some templating languages. We have some answers here regarding platform additions. Benjamin Hall would like to see a hex color initializer for UI color. And Christaps Grinberg has said, I would ask that you could use Swift Package Manager with iOS apps.
Well, using Swift Package Manager, you know, with iOS apps, that has to be on the roadmap, right? I imagine that's coming very, very soon.
It's got to be this year. It's got to be this year. If it isn't this year, there'll be an actual uproar, I think.
Dub, you think we'll see it then?
It's got to be, yeah. It can't be 10.2 now because that's basically happened. It's almost frozen at this point. So yeah, dub, I think this year, the big Xcode thing. In fact, my Xcode predictions for this year are, firstly, we'll see Swift Package Manager for iOS apps across the board. It'll be goodbye CocoaPods, goodbye Carthage, Swift PM for everything. And second, I think this will be the year where they finally go back to doing decent extensions in Xcode. We can write, forget those, you know, sort of source editor extensions. I mean real Alcatraz style extensions. We have some feedback here about taking things away from the language. One from Santos saying, I would remove type aliasing. I think it's an unnecessary level of abstraction that can make the code more readable to you, but more confusing for someone else trying to read the code. Using the original type is just fine in my opinion. Type aliasing is just too much abstraction for me. There's one here from Majid Jabrailov saying, I'd like to remove force unwrapping to keep the code base safe and remove possible crashes. And one from Michael Lyson saying, I flippin' well hate braces. Can we bin them off? These are all very interesting. I disagree, I think, with all of them. this is like good podcast, bad podcast, isn't it? You agree with everyone. I disagree with everyone. Santos wants to remove type aliasing. Type aliasing I don't use often, but when I do, it's really nice to have because it cleans up all your method definitions. It's like a simple way of organizing your code. And it's used by Swift extensively. You know, like codable is just a type alias for codable, encodable and decodable. Majid wants to remove force unwrapping. I love force unwrapping. I use it all the time. I mean, obviously not literally all the time, but I use it a great deal because I know this particular code is safe. If I try and typecast a return from instantiate view controller, it's either wrong or it's right. If I got the wrong view controller back, I can't recover from that at runtime. It's obviously broken. I'd happily die at that hill to force and wrap that perfectly well. And Michael hates braces. Well, I've been doing some Python recently, and trust me, it's much worse in Python.
I'm actually in the anti-type aliasing camp. I'm not saying get rid of them, right? It's nice to have it in certain, like you said, you don't use them a lot, but it's nice to have for those little situations. And I'm against people overusing them for everything. Let me clarify that. And John Sandel wrote a nice article about this recently. I talked about it on Swift News, and it made me think a little bit. There are certain specific cases, like, you know, types like int and double, where you want that to be more descriptive, more readable. I agree with that. But I often see people putting these very complex closures, you know, behind a type alias, you know, results handler or whatever. That's what I'm not a fan of, because as we all know, closures, you know, trip up a lot of people. They can be confusing enough as it is. So I like to see them kind of spelled out in front of me rather than have to go look at another layer of abstraction to see what's going on.
That's interesting, because I think one of the most common uses of type aliases is exactly for the abstraction.
Yeah.
Things like time interval. You know, what is a time interval? It's used all over the place. It's used in like animations and stuff. And it is a type A is for double. But it might not be. That's the nice thing. It might, in the future, they might say, actually, time interval, we want even more accuracy than double provides, or do something else. Sort of classic one of that is time T on Unix, where it's a special type, which happened to be integer, but it could be anything else in the future. So it leaves that sort of flexibility for source code compatibility while not being too confusing. We have some out and out requests for changes here. One from Morten Ditlevsen saying the if case dot A equals X and if case let always confuses me. I would like to have a test for equality and inequality to an enum case with associated value as an expression. And Louis de Baer says, more visible force unwrapping. Having the force unwrap operator take a message to make it more explicit and shorter than the current alternative of forcing a crash inside a guard statement. And Emmanuel Poser saying, accessing a character of a string just like a regular item in an array, despite the performance hit.
Yeah, so I'm going to disagree a little bit with Louis here.
You're on fire today. You're already angry.
Well, no, I was agreeing with everybody. Now I'm disagreeing. We're changing places here. So with a more, I like the guard let. I think he's talking about instead of having guard let and, you know, breaking inside the, you know, the scope of it, just having the force unwrap, you know, with a message. I don't know. I'm not really a fan of that. I will agree with Emmanuel, though, accessing a character of a string just like a regular item in array. Seems like any other language I've played with, you know, you're able to do that. Seems like Swift makes it a little more complicated.
A lot more complicated.
I was being nice.
Yeah, they've put in so much work. You know, Swift 5 strings are obscenely fast now. They're absolutely brilliant. And it's problematic because on the one hand, so much of our APIs are stringly typed in UIKit. You know, we're dequeuing things with identifier quite commonly, using image named and similar. We expect strings a lot of places. So having extremely well-optimized strings, you know, things less than 16 characters, for example, are lightning fast in Swift. It'd be a real shame to toss that away and go back to lower performance things. However, how much of a real difference would it make in actual applications? I don't know. It wouldn't be terribly hard for them to do this, to store them in an actual array of characters, but they choose not to, I guess with good reason. Morten's onto a point though. I think Morten's saying that the if case let syntax is bizarre in Swift. It really is. It just doesn't, I read it through out loud and it literally sounds utterly wrong, but it's the correct way of doing it. To check whether an enum has a certain value and read associated value at the same time is really, really headbangingly strange in Swift. But I think, you know, being able to check an enum with associated value for equality is problematic. Because what are you checking for? Is wind speed 10 and wind speed 90 the same or not? I don't really know. It's problematic. Anyway, one to end on, we have here from JK Cross. There's nothing. As far as my new brain understands, it's simply perfect. I even like strings. It feels good we finally found the person who likes Swift strings.
So that's going to wrap up this episode of Swift Over Coffee. But as always, we want to leave you with something to think about, and that is next episode's open ballot. Is there still money to be made on the App Store? If so, how?
Yes. Tell us your secrets of making money on the App Store.
And I promise two developers won't steal your ID and make money for ourselves. We won't do that, I swear.
Totally.
Nope,
not
going to happen. So.
Your secret's safe with us and all our thousands of listeners.
Speaking of all those listeners, we would love more. Tell all your friends to subscribe, leave a review, that helps us out a ton. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter @SwiftOverCoffee. We'll see you in the next episode.
Bye.